Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. Can everybody hear me up there in the back? Because I don't have the mic. I'm Monica Casper. I'm Director of Women's and Gender Studies. And thank you for coming on this really lovely warm afternoon when everybody's sitting out on the quad, and that's really special too. So thank you for being here. I'm really excited to introduce our speaker, Professor Tina Camp, who is our second annual Women's and Gender Studies Women's History Month lecturer. But before I do that, I want to gratefully acknowledge our co-sponsors for today's talk, which is a list that I think illustrates just how far-reaching and multidisciplinary Tina's work is. So many thanks to the Department of History, the Margaret Cunningham Women's Center, the Program in African American and Diaspora Studies, the Robert Penn Warren Center for the Humanities, the Bishop Joseph Johnson Black Cultural Center, the Department of Art and Art History, the Center for European and German Studies, the Department of Germanic and Slavic Languages, and all have helped to make today's lecture possible. Tina Camp is Interim Director and Associate Professor of Women's Studies at Duke University. A Vassar College alumna, she completed her graduate work at Cornell in German history. Her recently published book, Other Germans, Black Germans and the Politics of Race, Gender, and Memory in the Third Reich, tells the story of Afro-Germans and Afro-German women in particular under Hitler's regime. Her work is focused on questions of identity formation and the ways in which studying the history of Afro-Germans opens up new perspectives on the history of National Socialism. According to reviewer Eva Rosenhaft, Camp's principal purpose and achievement in Other Germans is to anatomize the way in which her subjects negotiated their own sense of self as gendered and racialized subjects in the face of the multiple points of reference offered to or imposed on them by the wider culture in their daily experiences. Together with Paul Gilroy, Professor Camp recently edited Der Black Atlantic, thank you. I don't speak German. A volume that explicitly takes up, and it was just that one little word, but I was worried. A volume that explicitly takes up and contributes to the field of German colonial studies, including the experience of blacks in Germany, which is considered to be one of the more lively fields in German history these days. In addition, she is a lovely and warm human being, and she was one of my very favorite colleagues at UC Santa Cruz when we both taught there, so I'm especially delighted that she's in town. Professor Camp's talk today is titled Pictures of Us, Race, Gender, and the Historical Image. So please join me in welcoming her to Vanderbilt University.
Okay, I have to tech myself out now. Can you hear me? Is this on?
Yes, it is.
Is it echoing frightfully? Do you want me to turn it off? That's the next question. Thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you also for the weather. Because that is, it's almost like a bonus to come here and it be wonderful weather, and I walked from the hotel over here, and you don't even have to pay me anymore. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's an honor to be here for this particular venue. But in honor of that venue, I have to begin with a caveat, and that caveat is that I am not and never have been a women's historian. Bow my head in silence. I'm really happy to... That actually also makes me even more thrilled to be giving this keynote. Because on the one hand, my work has never focused on women's history, but on the other hand, I really do think of myself as an extremely grateful beneficiary of all of those mentors of mine who have done women's history and who came before me and really did serve as my mentors during my graduate training. In a lot of ways, those of us in history know, those feminists in history, like me, know that they opened the doors for us, and we've learned a lot from them. So in that way, I'm thrilled to be doing this because it allows me to honor that tradition. My work has been influenced by those scholars, mostly because what I've become is a feminist theorist and a historian of racial and gendered formation. And in that way, my work is not confined to women's history or to the history as it has impacted upon women, but gender in a broader sense. And it frequently takes me into the realm of the impact of gender in constituting forms of masculinity and their reciprocal effects on women. So in my work, what I try to do is I really do try to bring feminist theory to bear on how we understand racial and gendered formation historically. As Monica has said, answering those questions for me has become something that makes me have to go beyond my training in history and has made me become an extraordinarily interdisciplinary person who relies on lots of different methodologies. And this piece is, in a lot of ways, a demonstration of that, sort of my most hyper interdisciplinary moment, because the new work that I'm actually doing puts me into a terrain that, for somebody trained in history, is scary. It's the terrain of visual culture and visual representation. That this new project focuses really on photography, on historical and archival photography. And it comes out of my book project on Black Germans in the Third Reich. And in a lot of ways, it's that moment. It's one of those projects that just doesn't turn me loose. It just keeps giving me new insights into other things. So I'm going to begin this talk with a second caveat, which is this is a new project, and I'm really asking a lot of questions in it. So that said, let me get to the meat of the question. Okay, so this talk has two sections in it, and this is section one. Section one is called Pictures of Us, Race, Gender, and the Photographic Archive. Photography is a form of archival imagery that in historical studies is all too often approached from a strictly documentary perspective. Here, photography is frequently used as visual evidence of history, and archival imagery is assumed to have an almost unquestioned realism. Contrary to this approach, I'm going to be coming at archival photography as a complicated and extremely mediated site of historical witnessing, through which we can read the emergence of submerged and yet contestatory, contradictory, and unruly gendered and racialized subjects. Rather than using photography in a narrowly documentary sense, I'll be highlighting the impact of photography as a powerful parallel site that stages the emergence of a Black German subject. The photographic subject that we encounter in this visual archive offers a striking account of how race and gender are always necessarily mutually constitutive. At the same time, this archive also exposes some of our deepest assumptions about and investments in seeing race and gender transnationally in the diaspora. These images serve as a complex site for understanding the friction produced around the issue of what race is and how it is registered, friction that structures both relations among communities in the diaspora as well as those beyond it. In this presentation, I'll be sharing with you a series of photographs that present Black Germans as individuals thoroughly emplaced in the German landscape rather than displaced from this social terrain in ways that reflect their status as profoundly German subjects. They enunciate Black Germans as diasporic subjects characterized less by movement and relations of origin to a lost homeland elsewhere than strong connections of dwelling and deep rootedness in Germany. Connections that have helped them to contend with the multiple violences of racism, racial purity, and exclusionary nationalism historically imposed by German discourses of national identity. Scholars have done much important work in tracing the cultural, political, and historical connections between Germany and Africa through their colonial and post-colonial relations, and scholars of the African diaspora in Germany have highlighted many of the cultural linkages between Black communities in Germany, on the African continent, in the Caribbean, and the Americas. However, my concern in this talk is with how Blacks have come to inhabit creative modes of belonging as Germans in ways that urge us to consider national belonging as an essential mode through which diasporic membership is negotiated and through which its transnational politics of difference and solidarity is often forged. The photographic images of Black Germans in the early 20th century offer us one of the earliest and most compelling places where we find such articulations of Afro-German belonging. These images are part of an emergent archive of Afro-German family photography that has only recently become accessible to a wider audience and unearthed through the archival collecting of a handful of diligent scholars. Here I'm specifically thinking of the pioneering work of historians Katarina Ogontoya and Paulette Reed Anderson, and more recently the work of Peter Martin and Christina Alonso, published in their catalog from the controversial 2002 exhibition in Cologne, Germany, on Black Germans in the Third Reich. In these collections of snapshots, portraits, and informal family photography, race becomes visible in ways that are inextricable from gendered embodiments of national belonging. As we will see, the domestic framing of this visual archive is particularly important. For these images of German domesticity figure an explicitly gendered familial structure, where racial difference is deeply embedded in both the family and the German nation. For the subjects instantiated in and through these domestic images consist not only of Afro-German boys and girls, but also, and equally significantly, white German mothers and black German sons and daughters. Here, race is always gendered in these images of primarily white mothers and black children, and their membership in the national body materializes as masculine and feminized forms of national and ultimately racialized subjecthood. The emergence of a black German subject in these scenes of domesticity staged in this photographic archive is particularly revealing, for the domestic frame gives us access to both a profoundly German subject that is racialized in ambivalent and contradictory ways, as well as a subject whose status in relation to the nation is affected through highly gendered forms of national belonging. What I'd now like to do is walk you through a few of these images and offer my own admittedly partial reading of them, one that I hope will help us to think about the mutual constitution of race and gender in photographic images of Afro-Germans. My aim is not to suggest that these readings are definitive, authoritative, or even completely accurate. In many ways, they are intentionally quite speculative. For my intent is to invite your own equally compelling counter-readings of these images, readings that I enjoy talking more about during the discussion. Section 2, Family Matters, Sites, S-I-G-H-T-S, I love wordplay, Sites of Diaspora and Belonging in Black German Photography. So now we're going to rev this up. Rev. See, you should be... I hear something good happening now. We're all coming into the technology of the age, right?
I teach in this room, and this is in my... Oh, you're there.
Oh, God!
It lasts more than it lasts. Coming down.
Okay. Right. Actually, let me turn down some of these lights. At first glance, this seems a relatively straightforward image, a baby photo, typical of many others taken by countless families, present and past. There seems little that's remarkable about such a photo. It could have been shot by any proud parent or family member attempting to capture an early moment in the life of a recent addition to the family. Looking more closely, the photo frames the infant as the undeniable center of attention. The child sits barefoot in a nonspecific, everyday garment, and his clothing is anything but meticulous. One side of the garment is not quite properly placed, exposing his shoulder as if he had wriggled out of a sleeve. It's at once casual and haphazard, and at the same time effortful and intentional. For although it may appear a spontaneous snapshot, the portrait of this child could not have been anything but labored. Indeed, as most parents will attest, looking at Monica, even the brief moment it takes to shoot such a photo would have cost far more time getting a child of this age to be still, even for the split second of a shutter snap. But perhaps we should step back rather than forward to appreciate more of the script this image writes for us. This photo was taken between 1921 and 1922. It's a photograph of Hans Hauck, an Afro-German man born in 1920, and an individual about whom I've written extensively elsewhere. Hauck was born in Frankfurt, Germany, and grew up in Duttweiler, Saarbrücken. He spent most of his life there until late in the war, but eventually returned several years after the war ended. He lived out the rest of his life in Duttweiler until his death in 2002. Stepping back even further, what is not at all apparent from the poses and expressions of this seemingly unremarkable boy... Oh, I need to plug it in. That's what I should do. All right. Of this unremarkable German boy is the fact that he was a child of a German mother and an Algerian soldier stationed in Germany as part of the French colonial forces deployed in the occupation of the Rhineland following the First World War. It tells us nothing of the public and diplomatic controversy surrounding this cohort of children and the ensuing propaganda campaign waged in German, French, and British newspapers that denounced the presence of these African troops and their biracial offspring as the black scourge of European culture and civilization and a disgrace and degradation to the white race. It gives no indication of the fact that 11 years later, the child pictured in this photo was sterilized as one of the so-called Rhineland bastards, vilified both in the interwar years and later in the National Socialist regime. But if we're honest, and maybe here we should just admit it, I would say that most of us would have to confess that this historical framing of this photo initiates a subtle shift in our view of this image. We refocus our gaze on skin color, hair texture, and the question of blackness. We begin to invoke and attempt to apply our own regional and cultural definitions and criteria for assessing race as blackness. Interrogating the optics of this photograph's rendering of race, we now ask how black, brown, or colored is or was he? In what ways does the photo register the traces of race or the historical moment at which it was taken? Does it give us any indication or foreshadowing of his ultimate fate under the impending regime of National Socialist Germany? Do we see the imprint of the black horror or the Schwarze Schmach in and on this image? Does it color or inscribe him as a Rhineland bastard, the discourse we assume indelibly shaped and circumscribed his life at the time? In many ways, such a response echoes one of the most persistent questions I've encountered over the years when presenting the oral accounts of Afro-Germans in the absence of these images. In other words, long before I had access to these photos. At the time, I was frequently confronted by what I found the extremely irritating query. So what do they actually look like? Yet now that I have access to this small collection of photos, ostensibly the visual documentation that would supposedly answer these questions, such questions persist and ironically have in fact multiplied, albeit in a different and somewhat perplexing form. For I frequently find that these images tend to invite and embolden people's desire to explain or more often to challenge or dismiss the racialized experiences of these individuals on the basis of their appearance. It's a phenomenon that can usually be paraphrased in the sentence, but he doesn't really look that black anyway. Or, I'm sure he probably passed as white, so I'm not quite sure you can really say that he was racially persecuted. Somehow, looking at these photos makes many people feel authorized to search for a way of contradicting or exceptionalizing Hans's account. In these cases, the photographic image seems to work together with the details of Hauck's biography and our own understanding of what constitutes a black subject to shift our focus to the issue of racial subjection and victimization. The simple fact of the date and circumstances of Hauck's birth in Germany as a child of the infamous Rhineland occupation acts as a kind of caption, an almost unavoidable historical captioning that aims to fix a particular meaning to this image. Here, the photograph almost solicits the viewer's license to question its subject's racial authenticity as either really black or truly racialized, based on his biracial heritage and light skin color. But what about the following photo? How does it signify? Equipped with the background history of this individual I've provided, how would we read this image text? Once again, the most obvious frames of reference seem to be oppositional ones. Attempting to read race and or blackness into the image according to our own culturally specific criteria, or reading it as archetypically German in ways that might seem to whitewash or erase the question of race. Like the previous image, this too is a portrait, but a family portrait of a different kind. It's a group photo that once again situates this family and the child in particular in a very middle-class milieu. The individuals in the frame are posed, arranged almost symmetrically, balancing height, gender, and generation. Two sisters flanking a brother or spouse, demonstrating the family bond with outstretched arms that link the generations and complete the kinship circle. A matriarch is seated centrally with grandchild to her left, his hand clasped inside of hers. The entire group is dressed in their Sunday best. Although this portrait was also taken outdoors, presumably in the same familial garden, it is more formal in its posturing and thus suggests the intervention of a more professionalized photographic gaze in the posing of its subjects. In this way, the photographer's gaze mimics and reproduces traditional portraiture conventions, and in the process, actively constructs a particular image of this family. For the portrait aspires to the image of a representative and respectable middle-class family of this era. The photograph thus marks not only the photographer's class and position, photographic portraiture also places the individuals captured within the frame in particular class positions. This informal portrait thus signifies at levels well beyond its content, composition, and framing, for its aspiration to middle-class conformity and typicality is generated neither solely nor primarily by the photographer. As Marianne Hirsch has argued, family photography is a site through which the family itself expresses and projects its desires and aspirations for social status and self-creation. Family photographs are thus an active medium through which the family constructs and reproduces itself, not necessarily as it was, but rather as it would like to be seen. In this context, the positioning of Hans Hauck as a biracial child of African descent in the photos of his white German family takes on special significance. As we shall see, the consistent figuration, his consistent figuration as an integral part of this family constitutes him as an Afro-German subject well in advance of the social and political discourses most often cited as enunciating this subject position several decades later. These two photos echo the previous portraits in important ways. Here again, the backdrop is the family garden. As in the previous image, his haircut, the iconic Prinz Eisenherz Schnitt, remains, although in these images, his hair seems fuller, perhaps revealing the return of its telltale wave. As with the first photo, we must also give voice to the silent traces and absent presences that lurk in its interstices, not only within the frame of the image, but also in our own readings and expectations of it when we set it in relation to Hauck's personal history. For a resurgent historical caption persistently haunts how we see and read each of these images. That caption is the ambivalence of race as blackness. As the child of an African colonial soldier, his heritage is a fact that, as Hauck himself recounted, signified loudly and with harrowing consequences throughout his life. For between 1935 and 1936, Hans was sterilized in a secret campaign carried out by the Gestapo against the black children of the Rhineland occupation on the basis of his heritage, and the dire threat these children were seen to pose to the purity of the Aryan race. Hauck's Algerian heritage thus rendered him a racialized subject, whose status as such justified his sterilization in the Third Reich. Yet in spite of the racialized production of his heritage, the impact of race on Hauck did not necessarily register through his skin color. Yet there's an almost irresistible urge to probe this image for evidence of race as phenotypical blackness. But the photograph stubbornly resists our attempts to reduce it to such a simple reading. Looking at the photo's composition and the portraiture techniques they enact, the Prinz Eisenherz Schnitt works together with the sailor suit to situate Hauck as a boy both of his time and of this particular cultural space. That his family chose or allowed him to pose in this particular quote-unquote costume betrays their participation in the production and projection of class, status, and milieu through this image. This prototypical Weimar outfit functions in some ways as a kind of uniform, one that serves both to situate Hauck historically in this particular era, as well as socially, by integrating him into his generational cohort. Like a uniform, it also conspires to situate him in a relation of conformity rather than exception to the dominant group. As I've argued elsewhere, and we'll see even more vividly here, uniforms came to play a particularly central role in Hauck's life history. Posed here with his mother, side by side, head almost touching head, his hand in hers, and in the garden yet again, the image maps the continuity of family, spatially, physically, and emotionally, throughout this series of portraits. Each of these images was intended to capture their respective moments for posterity. They were retained long after the passage of that moment, and thus served precisely this intended function. They were meaningful then, and the fact of their survival over a half a century later indicates they remained meaningful for someone over time. They are images that document inclusion rather than exclusion, exception, or marginality. Taken over time, these photos articulate not a momentary occurrence, but the longevity of relation, connection, and indeed a kind of indigeneity that I would argue diasporic dwelling ultimately breeds. For although it begins with migration or displacement from a home elsewhere, diaspora, and the African diaspora in particular, is not necessarily an endless trajectory that perpetually suspends an arrival somewhere. Put another way, I would argue that it's important to attend not only to questions of diasporic movement and forced and voluntary migration among Black people, but also to the ways that Black diasporic communities are also thoroughly emplaced and practice complex forms of homing and dwelling. Rather than privileging questions of mobility, rupture, or connections and continuities with original cultures and heritages, what is equally crucial to understanding the significance of the African diaspora is engaging the very local forms of cultural identity and subjectivity that diasporics like Afro-Germans stake claims to. For contrary to other scholars, I would contend that diaspora is not always intrinsically counter-national. On the contrary, the intergenerational dynamics of diasporic formation always make at least a provisional aspiration to national subjecthood a necessary part of any form of diasporic identity. In other words, diasporics are never merely citizens of the world, nor are they ever wholly transnational. Although many Blacks in the diaspora practice forms of belonging to multiple sites and communities due to the complex circumstances of migration, for some, belonging is an epistemological rather than ontological process of emplacement that itself involves active processes of articulation and identification. Here, local rootedness and national belonging is the ground from which transnational and diasporic affinities, differences, allegiances, and solidarities must necessarily be forged. The individual that emerges in and through these photos is an example of just such a subject. For in spite of his production as a racialized outsider, these images portray him as in no way an object of curiosity or scorn, but rather a subject. Indeed, a native Black and German subject, instantiated through his embedding in the existing structures of family. These photographs thus offer a powerful alternative representation of forms of belonging described much later by contemporary Black German authors as formative to their articulations of their African diasporic identities, and well in advance of current discourses of multiculturalism. As such, they witness modes of diasporic dwelling and national belonging at a much earlier moment in German history, when articulations of national belonging in Germany were even more strenuously defined and policed along the lines of racial and ethnic purity. These next two images are perhaps the most formal portraits contained in this collection. First Communion and a Wedding Portrait. Each bears the signs of the professional photographic gaze. Props and ornaments are carefully positioned in relation to the photographic subject. The individuals themselves are posed with precision and centered, frozen in time for the camera. These are commemorative photos marking significant familial events. They are occasions around which families converge and that serve as rituals of kinship, connection, and belonging. As such, these photos signify as articulations of community, familial, as well as cultural. As before, Hans is central to each frame. He is in no way marginal or peripheral. His presence is consistent even in these later photos taken following the death of his mother. This time, rather than his youthful Eisenhautschnitt, he has progressed to a more mature, though again iconic, haircut of this period. And now a much different set of photos. These two are images that speak volumes to the same issues, yet through a very different set of structural optics. There's no cursor. Oh, there it is. He's right here in the upper left corner on this photograph. And he's right here in the middle on that one. Unlike the previous series of photos, these images are institutional portraits. They are group photos that present individuals in the context of specific organizations. Both are organizations that typify the life of a youth in this period in Germany, and both are institutions which, as these photos document, counted Hans Hauck as a member, a primary school, and the Hitler Youth. As classic examples of institutional photography, their composition seems less interesting than the preceding images, perhaps due to the fact that their staging is so straightforward and predictable. The arrangement of the members of the group has little to do with the individuals themselves. They are organized generically, with placement achieved by height alone and authority figures taking up positions on the sides. Here, the individual dissolves within the group, for it is only the group that matters. However, although their structuring may be unoriginal, they offer some of the most provocative images in this archive. For what sets these photos apart from the previous series of images is the explicit emergence of gender to shape and define the captioning and capturing of race and subjectivity in crucially constituent ways. Both photos place Hans in the context of specifically male groups. In the Hitler Youth photo, he resurfaces again at the center of the frame. This photo was taken sometime between 1933 and 1935, and as such, documents not only his participation in the intended bastion of Aryan youth indoctrination, but also a particular moment in the regional history of this institution. For Hauck joined the Hitler Youth in a suburb of Saarbrücken in 1933, the year of Hitler's seizure of power, during its period of voluntary membership, and well before compulsory membership, or Jugenddienstpflicht, was instituted in 1936. In our interview, Hauck recounted that he joined the Hitler Youth, quote, like all other boys of his age. That's unfortunate. There we go. And he described his own desire at the time to belong to this organization, a group into which he was admitted in spite of his non-Aryan heritage, a fact facilitated by the locality of this group's structure. For the father of Hans' then's best friend was the leader of the local chapter. Here it's interesting to note that Hauck's admittance also preceded the Saarland's integration into the Reich in 1935. But to pose the question once again, how does this contextualization shape our view of Hauck's status in this image and this institution? Returning to the relationship between the two portraits' composition, in the transition between them, maleness morphs into masculinity through the military uniforms and stoic posturing of its members, as the image captures boys as soldiers in training. Hans, center stage yet again, is the only boy beyond the front row who adopts the defiant cross-armed pose. The background of the photo threatens constantly to overpower the photograph as more of a foreground, for the massive Nazi banners and swastika dwarf both the individuals and the group and magnify the status of nation, nationalism, and fatherland. The photo thus fuses nation, military, and masculinity, and in the process produces an explicitly masculine and nationalist German subject. Regardless of the interpretation we give them, each of these photographs provides only a partial account that surpasses any contextualizing caption we might give them. For although they document Hans's membership therein, they offer us no information about his time spent in the Hitler Youth, marching around in uniform and quote-unquote playing soldier, as he described it. Nor do they tell us anything about how or why he joined this group. They give us no indication of the fact that in the very same period during his membership in the Hitler Youth, he was sterilized as one of the so-called Rhineland bastards. Does it matter that sometime around, or shortly after this photo was taken, Hans Hauck was sterilized on the basis of his racial heritage? Does this fact influence or change our view of it? And before we attempt to reduce this individual to the status of an exception, potentially, and indirectly marginalize him once again, let us try to situate him in relation to other images of Black Germans in the everyday landscape of this period. What happens when we set these photos in relation to images of other Black Germans at the time? So now I'm going to show you some more photos of Hans. What I'm trying to show you is give you more of a landscape of him in relation, not only in relation to the story that I'm trying to tell you about these images. I'm trying to actually get you to think about what is the relationship between the story and how we see him, right? Because what I always have encountered is a desire to see him. But once you see him, you don't see him the way in which we want to see him, right? So the other thing I want to do is I want you to try and see other Black Germans in similar contexts. and ask ourselves, you know, what is the relationship between vision and the visualization of race and the histories that get told about racialization and whether or not they add up? And on the other hand, what is it that doesn't add up about them? And I would say it has more to do with us than it does with the photographs or the stories. So that's how, here again on the right. That's him again. Similar to the previous images, in these photographs we see Hauck in his uniform, though this time following his induction into the German Wehrmacht, which he was inducted in 1945. Yet we see no trace of what his experience was like as part of the Nazi army. What these images do not tell us is that he saw the army as a chance to survive the Third Reich, and that his decision to join up was taken after making a desperate attempt to flee this problem through a failed attempt at suicide in 1944. These photos give us no hint of the fact that shortly after his induction into the army, Hans Hauck was captured later that year on the Eastern Front and held as a prisoner of war by the Russians from 1945 to 1949. Nor do we gain any insight into the fact that, as Hauck explained it, being in the army was important to him because it was the first time he remembers, quote, being treated as an equal by his fellow Germans. Equally illegible in these photos is the fact that he recalled his experience as a POW as noteworthy because, as he described it, quote, I was treated just like other Germans. They, he's referring to the Russians, didn't make any distinctions. Although these images seem to tell us so much about Hans and his life as a German, of course there's so very much that we cannot see and that most certainly denies the possibility of visual representation. But once again, what happens when we put these photos in dialogue with images of other black Germans at the time? What does it do to our sense of German cultural identity and the African diaspora to see these seemingly exceptional photos as part of a larger story? This is Hans again in his Hitler Youth uniform. This is another black German child, a girl this time, in her BDM uniform, which is the girl's equivalent to the Hitler Youth. That is Hans Mastelkoy actually at school, and I just thought that was a very dear photo. But again, he's trying to actually, he too is wearing the insignia of a regime that was marginalizing him. That is one of the Ngando brothers, and I think that is Ewan, but I could be wrong. And this is his brother with his mother. Both of them were in the Reich's Arbeitsdienst. In these images of Hans Hauck that we saw previously, as well as those of the other black Germans I've shown here, life in the third, in these images of Hans Hauck, I hate it when I mess up. Race was both much more than phenotype, and at the same time, much less. Hauck's racial persecution was not based upon his skin color, but upon his racialization as a non-Aryan of African heritage, and the threat he was seen to pose to the purity of the Aryan race based on blood. Similarly, the horrific racial genocide of the Holocaust was also not established on the basis of visual alterity, but rather a racialized construction of non-Aryans and so-called unproductive subjects, who in the logic of this regime were deemed lives worth not worth living. Furthermore, as I've argued elsewhere, the Third Reich offers one of the most striking demonstrations of the extent to which race always works through gender, and gender necessarily through race. For during this regime, membership in the national body was defined not only by race, but also through appropriate and sanctioned enactments of gender and gender roles. In Hauck's case, he was able to lay claim to visible forms of masculinity through military organizations that legitimated him as a German as he transitioned from boyhood to manhood. Thus, the military in some ways came to replace the family later in his life as that which authorized his acceptance as a German during the war. But again, his status as a German subject was always already gendered, and indeed contingent upon the recognition of appropriate forms of masculinity. In this way, it's impossible to see or view the archetypal Germans pictured here without also registering both the raced and gendered processes of subject formation that produced them as such. This collection of photographs raises vexing questions about the implications of seeing race and blackness in the landscape of German history. For the Afro-Germans whose presence we have followed throughout this series of photos strenuously resist any straightforward reading of their images. For example, does light skin color or shade erase African heritage? Does gender, by way of masculinity and the military uniform, allied or disguise race? In what ways can we see racial visibility as muted or overwritten by gender in the images of Black German boys and men as masculine members of both the nation and the family? At a more general level, does the emergence of this Black German photographic subject in both everyday German context and in the hyper-German and hyper-masculine organizations like the Hitler Youth and the Wehrmacht erase their racial heritage in relation to their cultural identity as Germans? Finally, do these images production of extremely or perhaps uncomfortably German subjects, albeit of racial of African heritage, make us question or confirm their relationship to the African diaspora? To my mind, these images challenge us to examine the criteria through which we both see and define race and the role of gender therein. They help us to think about our underlying assumptions about what race is, how it relates to skin color, how it is produced as always already gendered, and in what ways race and gender both color and at times appear not to color our everyday interactions. For regardless of whether we see them or if we register or if they register to us as Black or not, these picture-perfect German national and diasporic subjects were and will at some profound level remain unruly and inappropriate. For they never quite fit the racially pure fiction of Germanness, nor for that matter, the archetypically mobile, cosmopolitan construction of a Black diasporic. Perhaps a more careful accounting and attention to the role of gender as foundational to racial as well as diasporic formation will help us to move closer to a more dynamic conception of national, transnational, and diasporic subject formation. At the very least, it will certainly help us to see things differently and hopefully more complexly. Thank you. If you have questions, I'm happy to respond. Yes, hi.
There is the one of a girl.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
And I'm very convinced by your narrative, perhaps because it's so masculine.
Right.
I wonder how you tell a story through a set of images where if the child were female.
Right.
Okay.
I had a conversation with a colleague of mine about this because, you know, as a feminist who is trained in history, I have been desperate to tell the story of women, of Black German women in the National Socialist regime. And I've always found it very difficult because, and my colleague and I kind of agreed that the problem there is that German national discourse was so profound, particularly in this era, was so profoundly masculinized, right? That I have to tell a different story for a female, because the modes through which Hauck and these other boys that we saw gain access to national subjecthood or belonging, that masculinity is something that is much more available. And there is not the same route to national belonging through a female subject, right? Because the female subject is the feminized subject is always theorized as a violation, right? And although the Black man is certainly hyper-masculinized as a threat, as the African, you know, historically, and particularly in this period, because, you know, that's the way in which the soldiers were figured, the Black soldiers, the Black occupation soldiers that, you know, he comes from, that he gains access to exactly, to Germanness through exactly the same register that actually disallows that also demonizes him. So I have to say that I'm challenged by that very question of how does one write this narrative through a woman? And when I was doing this work, when I was doing similar kinds of readings of Fazia Janssen's life history, what I found was that she didn't have that avenue of access, and therefore
it was a much more individual process of claiming membership in the German as a German national subject through the family. The family played a much bigger role, but it was a family that had to resist her marginalization. And so her family was much more resistant, as opposed to Hauck's family, which was actually striving towards a kind of normality that did not thematize it. But then again, I get into trouble with those individual histories. So you've asked the question that I can't really answer, that I'm actually trying to struggle for and struggle towards. And the part about it, about this particular project that I think or I hope is going to help me, is that through the images themselves, and I haven't gotten a lot of images of Black German girls yet. The ones that I showed you were the first ones that I've actually received, and I've only gotten those recently. And so I'm going to begin to work on those and hopefully be able to come up with an answer for you very soon. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, this is highly speculative.
Oh, please, speculate.
I have no idea whether this is going to make any sense, but women's identity
mm-hmm.
versus mothers. And so,
right. And so, say that again, I'm sorry.
Women's identity in the Nazi ideology was as mothers.
Right.
This they were totally sent back into the home and domesticated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking about, I mean, that part of the problem for you might be that that avenue wasn't really open to women who were labeled African.
True.
And because I'm struck by the fact that he was sterilized. And so what would it mean? I mean, his masculinity is being defined in a very restricted way.
Mm-hmm.
He's not allowed to become a father.
Right.
So if the identity for women is as mother, then mm-hmm. you're not going to want to highlight the reproductive capabilities.
Right.
Racialized subjects, then it seems to me that you don't have. I mean, it's a very interesting story.
Right.
That's
helpful to me, because what you're saying, and if I could take it a little bit further, is that that, for example, for Hans in particular, somebody who was sterilized, masculinity was recovered through the military as a compensatory site of subject formation, right? And there is no compensatory site of subject formation in the German national imaginary for a woman outside of reproduction, right? There is no site to reclaim that as, you know, a positive, accepted, authorized, you know, mode of inhabiting inhabiting the rubric of the German woman outside of if the reproductive component is taken out. Right, so that's very, very helpful to me, because it is a way of actually getting at that. And what I've been resisted to is there is no avenue for, right? But I might have to accept that, right? I might have to accept what you're talking about in terms of what you're gesturing towards in terms of, if we think about compensatory modes of claiming national belonging, right, through other forms of masculinity, right, that are not about sort of your potential to actually recreate and to propagate, you know, the fatherland, right? You can still serve the fatherland. You can still fight for the fatherland. You can still contribute in all these different ways. And if that avenue is not possible for women, so if there's not something available to them beyond the domestic sphere, right? And I've been resistant to that. I've been wanting to actually think about, try to find where that is, and maybe I'll find it. But on the other hand, it actually is a more compelling argument, because it shows a kind of resilience that for female subjects, for Black female subjects, that's disproportionate, that's not equivalent to that of Black male subjects. And I've often speculated about that, you know, there might be a sort of structural inequality there that, you know, allows the formation of national identity through masculinity, right? That's not there for women. And I've been resistant to that, but it's actually, this is very, very helpful to me, because it makes me see how that might actually work as an argument, as a way of understanding this. Thank you.
Can I ask a very specific question?
Yes.
Maybe I just didn't catch this. Where is his father?
His father went back to Algeria. I mean, that's something that I'm seeing in the photographs that I'm collecting, is that, you know, except for the one that I showed you here where there was that complete family, there are very, very, very few images of families where the Black parent is present, right? And the way in which I find myself reading those is that absence becomes that much more significant, right? And so it, particularly the way in which you're trying to actually figure domesticity without a father figure, right? So it's already a domestic frame that's missing something, that's compensating and trying even harder, you know, to present itself as normal in this absence. And this absence is profound because that is the black paternal figure, right? There was the constant threat. There was the constant threat. The problem there is that sterilization, that black Germans fell between the cracks of the sterilization policy, right? So that Hans Hauck was sterilized because he was a Rhineland bastard. That was a specific program that was a specific sterilization program that was illegal. According to the laws, the racial laws, the compulsory sterilization laws, because the compulsory sterilization laws stipulated that there had to be some genetic illness or just genetic dysfunction. And that category of genetic dysfunction was broad and not genetic in any way, right? So, you know, chronic laziness was one of those categories. There was no explicit... there was no category under which these healthy black German kids could be sterilized under. Therefore, they were sterilized in a special program. But then again, there was an absence of a recognition that there was a black German population outside of the Rhineland children, right? So if you were not a Rhineland, one of those children, and those children were actually captured, statistically, meaning they knew where they were, because they were illegitimate children, and in Germany and under the German social welfare system, illegitimate children were registered with the state, who was their official guardian, right? So they had records of who they were and where they were. So in that way, once they wanted to sterilize them, they knew exactly where they were and could sterilize them. They couldn't compulsorily sterilize them because of there was no law to actually justify it. So they actually sent, they had to get parental permission, and they sort of, you know, coerced parental permission through very sort of elaborate kinds of justifications that parents and guardians didn't have to sign on for, but did, right? Just thought this is what they had to do. So there were girls within those categories. Others were not sterilized because they were not part of this group. And there was no way to actually, you know, you couldn't just bring somebody in and say, sterilize this person. There was an entire legal process that they were trying. I mean, that's, you know, the key to the Nazi regime was its bureaucracy and its, you know, its very specific legal structures. So. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about Hans Hauck's mother? When you're making this interesting argument about race and gender and gender and race, mm-hmm. and following our Mm-hmm. How does the mixed race relationship between the mother and child disrupt that? Say more about the mother.
I can say only a little bit, but I want to understand a little bit more about your question. How does it disrupt what? The maternal, okay.
How does this connection between, on the one hand, this axis of race and gender mutually constitutive, and on the other,
right.
Nationalism.
Right.
So you okay. have a white woman who's presumably doing what she's supposed to be doing, but with a child who's seen as other. So what happens there?
Right. Well, I can't say a lot about her in particular because mm-hmm. she died when he was quite young. From his account of her, she died when he was around 7. So his account of her was that they had a very, very close relationship and that she was Welcomed within her family, and that, and he does emphasize his family as being extremely crucial to his formation as a German and to his survival of this regime. But the point that you're making is a really interesting one, because she was reproductively active within the confines of maternity, but she did have a child that was both out of wedlock and black. Right, because she was never married, and at that particular moment, at that particular historical period, the illegitimacy was probably as profoundly sanctioned as his race or his heritage. Right, so the thing that he has talked about is the way in which he recounts it, and of course this is secondhand because he wasn't there, he was being born or being carried, is that she had reported to him that she had a relationship with his father, that she had introduced him to the family, that the family had accepted him that as a relationship, but that it was the fact that she got pregnant out of wedlock that was the problem. And for that reason, she moved to Frankfurt to have the baby. And they brought her back because they said, you know, you're our child. And so, and the father was sent back, was transferred back home, as many soldiers who had children or liaisons with German women were. But let me, I'm trying to think about the actual question of how does that undo, or how does that challenge this particular rubric. Well, you know, there's part of me that wants to say that that doesn't want to actually, that wants to use this story as a counter narrative to the dominant narrative of all women who had black children were persecuted, because it doesn't seem that she was. He did experience, you know, racism. He did experience, you know, being called names and things like that in the street. He does talk about that. He did talk about that. But at the same time, he talked about his interiority and his acceptance. So for her, you know, and of course I'm feeling awkward about speculating, it seems my argument would be the same as with him, is that we have to actually think about locality and the way in which that often goes against the dominant narrative. And that, for me, that's the larger question about understanding the Nazi regime and the relationship between these discourses of nation, purity, maternity, and masculinity as being top-down narratives, top-down discourses that do have traction on the ground, but that on the ground, the local context in some ways rewrite those narratives in different ways based on how those communities themselves interacted and dealt with it. And so what the larger point that I think is important to think about is that there were contestations that were both, the reason that National Socialism was so successful was because of the way in which it wasn't simply top-down, it was actually very participatory on the ground. But at the same time, those forms of participation were also contestatory and resistant that allowed people like Hans Hauck and people like the others that I interviewed to survive. So that there were these interruptions on the local level. They did not necessarily have any impact on the way in which that discourse was produced as a public and global kind of discourse, nationalist discourse. So I guess that what I would want to think about in relation to your question is in what ways were there alternate scripts of maternity and femininity that were always in play, right? And that we have to understand the way in which these constructions were mobilized for certain sort of nationalist and racist projects as having a double edge. Right, that they can be inhabited in ways that, you know, completely go against the grain and allow for the production of subject, the very subjects that this regime was actually trying to annihilate or inhibit from ever coming into being. And you know, that's kind of my larger argument, is that National Socialism really did produce the black German subject that Hans Hauck and Fazia Jensen and other people became by virtue of the fact that it gave them no other possibility than being German, right? So on the same level, it gave her no other possibility but to be a mother, right? In spite of the fact that she was the kind of mother that they abhorred, right? That they were working against. Did you raise your hand?
Well,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think that gets at this other the narrative that you show with these pictures is tight, mm-hmm. right? I have no trouble. I have no invitation. I have no interest in critiquing the view that the boy has offered to him this alternative means of constructing his civic identity.
Okay.
Right. I there's nothing. I love that. I mean, and there it is. It's so obvious. But there's that black girl, mm-hmm. and she's dressed in this, not the military outfit, but the military equivalent outfit. So I'm wondering, I hear her, that's interesting, but I'm looking for a thought process behind it.
Right.
And then in your answer to Monica, I'm hearing this up, I think this is actually where you're going, and maybe I'm too obtuse to have heard you just say it, but I hear you in your answer to Monica that this woman, the mother, is a rebel too. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. this illegitimacy is something that needs, that would be policed, is something that is self-policing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about how individual families negotiate that policing is they conform even more.
Right.
But in conforming, they're resisting.
Right.
Right. And I think that's that. I think you use the word double-edged.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, I think that's a very fascinating thing to think about in this context, the one you're offering us, but I'm going to take this one home with me to other venues and just explore when people's real conformity is actually a form of resisting the police.
Is resistance the right, I'm struggling with the word, I mean, they're rewriting.
Right.
But I'm struggling with the concept of resistance.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that you're actually, I have to say that, I have to say that I think you're putting this in a much, I think you're giving me much more credit than I do here, because I think that you're actually taking it to a much more productive level that I too am going to take home. And that I also think that you're right in terms of, you know, resistance is so freighted with a kind of emancipatory politic that we're not there yet in these particular kind of practices. But, you know, I talk about rearticulations, right? And I talk about those rearticulations as being sites of potential resistance, right? Can be pushed in different directions. Don't necessarily have to take on that form, but we do have to actually sort of think about what ways, what forms, what spaces of agency they then create. Right, and so I think that you're absolutely right, and I what I'm reminded of in the way in which you're formulating this and thinking it further is I'm reminded of work by people like Windance Twine and by Jackie Brown in her work on Liverpool, who are looking at mothers of biracial children and how, you know, what their role is in subject formation and the spectrum of those who are truly, you know, trying very hard, who are involved in anti-racist practices and are trying to actually articulate a subject position that makes their children's lives possible, right? That's not the script that they're given, right? To others who are actually, you know, agents in a different way, right? And that I think that it's really important to actually think about that range of possibilities and not necessarily cop to a simple reading of resistance, right? This is resistant, because that I don't think allows us to see the nuance or complexity of what's going on there. So, I mean, this dialogue is very, very helpful to me in helping me to think about, you know, what is the space there that we could actually explore that would give us, you know, lead us into something productive, you know, theoretically, conceptually, historically productive that helps us to explain certain things. Or at least, my desire is always really modest, to just be able to see it in a more complicated way. You know, that's what I tell my students. Just leave with a more complicated perspective, and that's a victory. So, go ahead.
Can I ask a simpler question? When you were talking before about how one way you just want to use this narrative as a counter-narrative to the mm-hmm. dominant discourse that these mixed-race children were always victimized.
Right.
And I'm stuck on the fact that you could pass.
Yeah.
So do you have other stories of mixed-race children who couldn't pass?
Yeah, also, I hate that question. I know, but you know, I think I already like you, so that's okay. I mean, that's the question that I always want to ask. Pass according to whose measure, right? Well, no, he didn't pass, you know, on some level. You know, he got yelled at on the street, you know? So if his victimization was not necessarily always about skin color, right? Because he wasn't sterilized, you know, the most profound form of victimization that he experienced, he did not experience on the basis of the way he of passing or not, right? So that's the way in which I have to ask that question. And yeah, and then I always go back to Fawzia Janssen's story, which is about, you know, where I don't know that she was more or less black looking than he was, but she certainly did have frizzier hair, you know. And when we get down to those sort of details of, okay, and could she have passed if she had access to, for example, this kind of uniformed form of, you know, gendered subject, gendered German subject position, right? So I have to always ask, why did he pass, and according to what, you know, according to what codes and criteria and what context did he pass? And I'm more interested, I'm more interested in what enabled passing. And I think, you know, I'm much more compelled by the he passed when he was in uniform argument, right? And then to interrogate what is it about the uniform that lets people not see certain things, because that's what passing is about. What becomes less visible, right? And the uniform makes certain things less visible by reference to a particular kind of appropriate masculine, appropriate gendered national belonging. So, you know, and maybe, I hope I'm not dodging the question, but that's the productive way that I think about it, is what enables passing and why, and then to think about how our optics, right, the optics of how we read somebody, you know, define race in that very moment. And I like to actually think about that in all of the contexts when we're talking about passing. So it's not about you passed or they passed. It's about when is it that we decide not to see race, right? Or when is it that we decide that we think that race is visible? And that gets us closer to, you know, the politics involved in, you know, recognizing blackness or not, rather than, you know, the very, very justifiable reasons that one wants to enjoy the privilege of whiteness, you know, and disavow the persecution that goes along with blackness, you know, because I really do want to resist the very simple narrative of passing as disavowing, you know, race and heritage and our people, right? There are, you know, the politics of race in any given context are that one would like to have more privileges than one is entitled to on the basis of race. And that's not those individuals making. You know? So.
No, in my head swimming now, the comparison I'm trying to draw is to Jews during the Third Reich.
Right.
And
yeah.
And the visible and the blood. And
right.
How those intersected and what was possible and what wasn't possible. But, you know, I mean, I just...
Right, I mean, on that level, I mean, I've had people respond to these photographs by saying, well, you know, he actually looks very Semitic, you know, on some level. And he could have been seen as, you know, just, you know, an Ashkenazi, a Sephardic Jew. And, you know, very well could have been. And, yeah, but also, you know, if we're talking about the Jewish community, it's, you know, if we ask about the same, if we take the same analytic frame in terms of passing, you know, then we're actually talking about what makes Jewishness visible, you know, and how incredibly, you know, random that is, and how incredibly invested with, you know, social meaning or what a production of social meaning that is. But there I think that the most crucial sort of turning point is the question of a community, the recognition of a community and the identification with a Jewish community. And, you know, we don't even have to get into the historical availability of the Jewish community as scapegoats for, right, as an available site onto which project the national anxieties of Germany, right? We don't even have to go there. It's about the fact that there was a community, and on some level there was a desire to identify with Jewishness that in turn, right, co-constructs that moment of what is Jewishness and where do we see it, right? So I want to actually get underneath the really convenient and familiar ways that we actually already understand these categories.
I was going to say that what struck me was a similarity with like sexuality, how homosexual men joined the Reich and then were persecuted, and how this idea of passing not only works with race and Judaism, but with sexuality, and how some might have tried to pass as straight.
Right.
And yet, you know, that thin line of, you know, black, white, straight, not, you know, who's persecuted and who's not. That's just what struck me. And how, like, with sexuality, you not necessarily can see it, and yet some would say,
they
could.
Yeah, you construct that category as something that you can identify, right? And that those attributes are not attributes that are necessarily visible. Those are attributes that become meaningful as defining this person as queer, for example, right? And yes, I would agree with you. It's, you know, what happens when we actually think about the process through which these characteristics become categories that mean something and then are attached to some visible, affective moment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For a wonderful conversation.